pleasure then to ask Brother Simon to continue with his study of the Temple of Ezekiel's prophecy, and in particular this first address entitled Chamber of the Singers. Brother Simon,
my dear brethren and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, Brother Tony in his opening remarks said something to the effect that we would continue with Ezekiel on his journey through the temple. And it is indeed our intention, God willing, to endeavour to do just that. We have seen the outer courts and the buildings of the outer court. We have seen the gates that lead through those buildings and into the inner court, and then into the outer court, sorry, and then into the inner court. And we've seen the corner courts. And so now we come to the house, to the tabernacle, as it is called in one place, and indeed to the altar itself, which is in the centre. Now, perhaps of all of the suggestions which Brother Sully puts forward, and we should like to emphasise, incidentally, that a good deal of what Brother Sully says are suggestions. He's nowhere near as dogmatic as some of us like to make out. But that by the by. Something which has taken most of the criticism is the circle and the altar in the middle. Now, we'll come to the circle a little later. But just ponder, first of all, the overall concept of an outer range of buildings, an inner range of buildings, and in the centre, an altar. Contemplate, because this is quite contrary to the arrangement which has been seen, particularly in the tabernacle. And the argument goes, well, if it was right for the tabernacle, why should this arrangement be something different as far as the age to come is concerned? To which the response is that this building is for a completely different purpose. In the tabernacle, the offerer brought his offering to the door, and the priest who officiated took it to the altar. There was no other purpose within the confines of the tabernacle. Within the confines of the temple, however, there are a whole range of activities which take place, some of which we may have mentioned on a previous occasion, but all of the things which we associate with the priesthood and with a people willing to go and worship God and learn about him and his ways and to bring their sacrifices and so on, all of these things have to go on, not outside of the temple, but within its confines. And so we see a larger building and we see a range of buildings for different purposes. And whereas the altar in the tabernacle, we feel, if we look at the records which account the journey of the Exodus, we find that the nation of Israel were particularly wayward and idolatrous, and the altar would not exactly have been overused. But in this temple, brethren and sisters, the people of the earth are going to come and worship at this temple, and they are going to come and bring their offerings. And those offerings are going to be offered on an altar which is far larger than anything which has been built previously. But we'll come to the details one by one. And so then, looking at plate two, we can see that Ezekiel has gone round the outer courts, he's been through the gates. And as he would approach across the separate place, the separate place is the almost triangular portions of the inner court, which divide off the holy from the most holy. The most holy is within the circular temple, and the holy is contained within the square. And so, marked B on plate two is called the separate place, and he would go across there and he would go into the temple itself, and he would be able to see then the altar which is in the middle. And so he would have seen, as he went through the gate into the inner court, something like that. We say something like that because, as we said before, Brother Sully himself is nowhere near as dogmatic as he might have been, or we might think he would have been. And with that in mind, we're going to have a look at the last part of chapter 40 and a good deal of chapter 41 by way of our first half. Just one or two points before we take that off the screen. We're looking at plate 11, which is the view of the circular temple. We see around the base of the temple, we see stairways here, marked off by divisions of quite large bases. And we have a base which has a column at the one end. We have the stairway working across from right to left. We have a base which has a cherubim on, and then another base with a column, and so on across the face of the building. We'll look at these on plan in a moment. We see on the right hand side of plate 11 that there is a large wall, and that large wall runs the full height from the foundation here right the way up to the arch at the top of the building, and forms a stable wall for structural reasons, which we shall see in a moment. We also see along the face of the building and going along the roof a covering, and we see exposed in various places a sort of a trellis work. All of these things we shall endeavour to look at in a little more detail. And just so as we can grasp the scale of this building, as we see the stairway down here, you can just about make out some people right at the bottom in the middle. And they're really walking up almost through the foundations, because the building here is on a slope, or at least the floor, that part is on a slope, as we would imagine, because this is part of the Hill of Zion, remember, and so we would expect the outside of the circle to be at a lower level than the inside, and so this is why we see a slope in this open part here and some steps going up inside, which aren't repeated on the other side. And so just a bit of background then, and we shall try and look at that in a little more detail. We shall spend most of our time this evening looking at this diagram, which is plate 9, or at least part of it. I well remember as a child flicking through the book which I found in my father's room, that when I came to this one, I thought this looked incredibly complicated, and what's more, I thought it wasn't quite right, because it was obviously, I assumed that these lines should all be exactly square and rectangular and so on, not appreciating at that age that what we're actually seeing is a very small part of a circle. And so we would expect, coming from the top to the bottom of plate 9, to be upon a small arc of a large circle, which is why it appears to be sort of on the skew. It's not wrong, it's exactly right. We shall endeavour to look at some of this in a little more detail as we progress. But first of all then, verse 44. And in doing so, we shall go back to plate 2, the block plan of the temple. Verse 44 then of chapter 40. And without the inner gate were the chambers of the singers in the inner court. Now let's stop there for a moment. We know that Ezekiel has been through the gates of the inner court, marked F on plate 2, and he now goes through and he sees the circular buildings and describes them as being in the inner court. Now that is a very simple but most crucial expression, because it tells us that when Ezekiel had been through the gates of the inner court, when he went inside of those gates, then he saw another range of buildings, which tells us conclusively just by the use of that one little word in, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that what he is about to describe is inside the square part of the temple, which we have already seen on previous occasions. So any arrangement is immediately doomed to failure. It cannot be right, because only with this type of arrangement can we satisfy the first part of verse 44, which says that having gone through the inner gate, without the inner gate, and without means to sever, and so severed from the inner gate, he finds these buildings. And this is why we have a space marked H on this particular plan. So there's a gap then between the gates of the inner court and the circular range of buildings. They are separate buildings, they are cut off, they are without. And so we find he comes to what he describes as the chambers of the singers, which are in the inner court. And we just want to look at two references concerning the singers, because we shall immediately discover the purpose of these buildings. The first one's in the margin. It's Chronicles, 1st of Chronicles, chapter 6. First of Chronicles, chapter 6, and verse 31. These are they whom David set over the service of song in the house of the Lord, after that the ark had rest. And they ministered before the dwelling place of the tabernacle of the congregation with singing, until Solomon had built the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, and then they waited on their office according to their order. And these are they that waited with their children, of the sons of the Kohathites, Heman, a singer, the son of Joel, the son of Shemuel. Now Shemuel is Samuel. And so here we see Samuel's grandson, and he is mentioned on several occasions, and he has a most important role to play. Described here as a singer. And go back to verse 31. They are set over the service of song. And in verse 32, they waited on their office according to their order. And still in the middle of verse 32, they were in the dwelling place of the tabernacle of the congregation with singing. So they were in the tabernacle until the temple was built. And so singing then forms an important part of worship. And it is an important part, so important, that when David and Samuel establish the order of things to be done when Solomon was to build his temple, singers were specifically given this special task. It wasn't left to those who thought it was their forte, and they hoped that they got enough numbers and all this sort of thing. Specific families were given a specific task because it is important. And we come across the importance if we stay in 1st of Chronicles and go to chapter 25. First of Chronicles, chapter 25, and verse 1, first of all. Moreover, David and the captains of the host separated unto the service of the sons of Asaph, and of Heman, the same Heman that we came across before, and of Jeduthun, who should prophesy with harps, with psalteries, with cymbals. And the number of the workmen according to their service was, and thus and so. And so there we begin to see now the reason that the singing is important, because it is described in the middle of verse 1 of chapter 25 as prophecy. In other words, teaching. So whereas we tend to associate the singing of hymns with worship, within the age to come, brethren and sisters, I'm sure that will indeed continue. Here we're being told that part of the purpose of the singing was to teach. And if we continue on into verse 5, we read, "And all these were the sons of Heman, the king's seer, in the words of God, to lift up the horn. And God gave to Heman 14 sons and 3 daughters. And these were all under the hand of their father for song in the house of Yahweh with cymbals, his harps, and all the other things." And so music and singing, notice the seer in the words or the matters of God. So the teaching, brethren and sisters, those so vital elements of doctrine, part of the means of teaching these things to the nations in the age to come as they come up to this temple to worship, will be by means of singing. As we feel that the organisation which was established by David and put into practice by Solomon will be repeated in the age to come. And so then, coming back to our chapter, Ezekiel and chapter 40, verse 44, the chambers were for the singers. And so this inner range of buildings then, the circular range of buildings, is the place for the singers. And so these singers will be teaching the people. And so it is within this range of buildings that the people will go and be taught of, as we read in Chronicles, the matters of God. And so it is a huge place of education in the things of God, done by the singers. And so, still in verse 44, they were told were in the inner court, which was at the side of the north gate, and their prospect was toward the south. One at the side of the east gate, having the prospect toward the north. Now this description has caused no end of confusion for those who will not accept that there is a circle. Because if we have a circle, we can be at the north gate, still in plate 2, and we can see that the northernmost part of the circle can be described as having its aspect toward the south. That's an overall description, obviously parts of it point in different directions. But nevertheless, this part which is associated with the northern gate can be described as looking toward the south. Now logically we might expect that by the south gate had the prospect toward the north, but that isn't the way it is described. It's quite carefully described as, at the end of verse 44, one at the side of the east gate having the prospect toward the north. Now because we are dealing with two parts of a circle, as far as the southernmost part of the circle is concerned, we could be at the south gate, but then again we could be by the east gate, or indeed over on the western side, and any part of this circle or semicircle on the southern side can be described as having its prospect toward the north. He does not say that he stood by the east gate and looked north. He said he was by the chambers of the singers, who were by the east gate, which indeed these were, and he looked toward the north. It could also, of course, incidentally be said that the northernmost ones are by the east gate. They both are. But that doesn't do away with the solution that Brother Sully has come to. You can be in this range of buildings and look toward the north. That is, you can be on the east or the south or the west, still looking toward the north. And so we would suggest that a circle is the only way in which we can satisfy this general description of the northern buildings looking toward the south and the eastern buildings looking toward the north. As soon as you go away from a circle, you have immense difficulties with that description. And so we have seen then that the circle is divided into two parts, the prospect to the north and the prospect to the south. And so in verse 45, he said unto me, this chamber whose prospect is toward the south, so he's in the northernmost semicircle looking south, is for the priests, the keepers of the charge of the house. Now we may recall from last time, or a previous time, that the priesthood is split into two. There are those whose concern is the charge of the house, the mundane, but as we demonstrated before, so important things, and they are the mortal Levites. It is they then who are part of the northernmost, or have the northernmost chambers. And in verse 46, the chamber whose prospect is toward the north, so in the southernmost portion then of the semicircle, is for the priests, the keepers of the charge of the altar. These are the sons of Zadok, among the sons of Levi, which come near unto the Lord to minister unto him. And so as we saw before, the two parts of the priesthood, and now the immortal part of the priesthood, the sons of Zadok, those who approach unto Yahweh, they have the southernmost portion, whose prospect is toward the north. And so, having given us a general description of the circular range of buildings, he then gives us a general description of the one thing he hasn't yet described, which is the altar. Now, verse 47 doesn't actually tell us it is the altar. For we read, so he measured the court. So we've been given a general description of a circular building, and now he measures something which he describes as a court, 100 cubits long, 100 cubits broad, 4 square. We're then told the altar that was before the house. And so it would seem that the court which is described as being 100 cubits square is the court of the altar. And it is described in the end of verse 47 as being before the house. And the word before means in the presence of. Now remember, the house that he's describing is the circular range of buildings. We've been told that the southernmost part has its prospect toward the north, and the northernmost has its prospect toward the south. And so we're told that the circular range of buildings is regarded as looking inwards. And so therefore, when we read at the end of verse 47 that the altar is before or in the presence of the house, it seems to me to be reasonably straightforward that the altar is in the centre of a circle. And so, having gone to the centre, marked D on plate 2, of the circle, he's measured the altar, he's given us no detail, because this is just a general description first of all. The detail follows in some other parts. He then comes back in verse 48 to the outer edge of the building, or to be more precise, we should say the inner edge of the building. And if we now move to plate 9, the inner part of the circle is on the left, and he is approaching those parts which we see, which generally speaking are hatched along the left hand side of the diagram. And he brought me to the porch of the house. Now we need to distinguish between the porch and the house. Now we may remember that when we looked at the outer court buildings, there was a building and a porch. Just to remind ourselves, we're now looking at plate 7. There was a building on either side and a porch associated with it. And the porch was given different, separate dimensions from the building. The building was 40 going through, remember, and then another 10 for the porch. Now, we have what can only be described as something which is vaguely similar. I say vaguely because it's much more grand. It goes for several stories. It had a lot more detail within it. But the principle remains that we have a porch and a building. And the building itself, that is the temple itself, is delineated by the large sort of T-shaped columns they are, which we'll see that in a moment, along either side. As we come to the outside of the building, we're now on the right-hand side of plate 9, we see a similar arrangement, very similar, just very slightly larger because it's on the outside of a circle, but we'll come to that in a moment. Now this may mean a great deal to those who are used to looking at plans. On the other hand, it may be rather more confusing. Having looked at, that is exactly the same diagram as we saw before, which was plate 9, what we've endeavoured to do is to bring plate 9 together with plate 10. Now the significance of that is, if we just explain it for a moment or two, what we have in plate 9 is a plan view. We are looking down onto the floor plan of the building, and so looking in the centre of plate 9 we see the sort of square shapes which represent the bases of the main columns which support the building. As we come to the left and the right side we see the porches. And on the left and the right side we see circles, which are hatched through in black, which represent the circular columns which form the porch. Now if we move up to plate 10, we see exactly the same thing, but we see a cross-section. If we look in the middle, we see the columns going right up through the building. And we see, so on the right hand side we can see columns which turn out to be circular columns, and we see here more clearly on plate 10 on the right and the left hand side we see the porch clearly sticking out from the temple itself, which, as we said before, the dividing line is the main posts of the temple as they are described on the right and on the left hand side, which on plan look T-shaped. We'll see why in a moment. We can see just in passing that the main structure, as we look at plate 10, is one of arches. And that would indeed be a very strong structure indeed. And as we come to the porches, we can see that the porch would provide a buttress to the right hand and to the left hand side, providing a great deal of strength to the building and to the arches themselves. We can also see, as we stay with plate 10, the lion and the man, the cherubim, which we saw in elevation on the other diagram which we saw. And we see on the right hand side of plate 10, remember we saw some steps when we saw the elevation, and here are the steps on the right hand side, quite tiny, because we're trying to see the whole of the diagram. Now for those of you that are expert in looking at plans and elevations and sections, please don't be put off by the fact that they don't line up exactly. The scales are slightly different, which, as I said, if you're an expert in these things, may cause confusion. If you're not, you probably haven't noticed anyway. So we'll come then to verse 49. No, we don't. We come to verse 48. Verse 48, "And he brought me to the porch of the house, and he measured the post of the porch, 5 cubits on this side and 5 cubits on that side, and the breadth of the gates was 3 cubits on this side and 3 cubits on that side." Now the diagrams, as we try to look at plate 9, it is dimensioned, What we're going to do now is look at an enlargement of plate 9, and we're going to look at an enlargement of the left-hand side of plate 9, which should show the dimensions a little more clearly, I hope. And so, verse 9, the post of the porch. And the post of the porch is marked B on this enlargement, and it refers to the cross-hatched area which forms a base to the porch. If, for a moment, we just look at plate 11, we shall see them in elevation. Now this, be careful, this is the outside of a circle, is plate 11. What we're actually describing is the inside, but the principles remain the same with the exception of the stairs. And so what we're having described for us in verse 48 is the post of 5 cubits as space between. And the post is the foundation which supports the circular column which is above it. So these posts along the bottom, 5 cubits across the face, so to speak. And now if we come back to plate 11, we shall see that where it's marked B on the plan on the left-hand side, we're just describing the width of the base underneath the circular column. And then in the end of verse 48, we find and the breadth of the gate was 3 cubits on this side and 3 cubits on that side. So the 3 cubits refers to the space between the bases or the posts already described. And you may be able to pick out, it's quite small, but the space which is marked C on plate 9 is 3 cubits wide. So on either side of the 5, there is a 3, a space of 3 cubits on either side, and so that's the 5 and the 3 which are mentioned in verse 48. Now we come into verse 49. And the length of the porch was 20 cubits, well that's fairly straightforward. As we come in from the inner face, travelling from the inside of the circle, from the altar side as it were, coming through the porch towards the main building, and remember these posts mark the start of the temple itself, the full width across there is 20 cubits. You may be able to see just between the two letter P's, still on plate 9, a length there of 20 cubits. So the width of 3 cubits, that space there, is 20 cubits long. And then we read in verse 49, and the breadth was 11. Well, the 11 comprises the dimensions which we've already spoken of. We've already spoken of a space of 3, a post of 5, and a space of 3. Or, to be more precise, as we were pointing to the diagram, what we should have pointed out was a space of 3, a column base or post of 5, and another space of 3, combining to make the 11, which are mentioned in verse 49. And he goes across to the other side, he sees some steps, but never mind that. Come to the end of verse 49, and there were pillars by the posts, one on this side and one on the other. So he has seen the pillars which are supported by the posts. These, remember, are the pillars. If we go back to plate 11, the pillars would support the structure of the porch. Remember, we're still in the porch, not in the house yet, on top of the posts. So, moving on to chapter 41 and verse 1. Afterward, he brought me to the temple, and he measured the posts. So now we have come through the 20 cubit measure. He's come across the corridor, although he hasn't mentioned it yet, we'll come to that in a moment, and he's looking at these posts, which are marked D on plate 9. And he measures them, and we read, and he measured the posts 6 cubits broad on the one side and 6 cubits broad on the other side, which was the breadth of the tabernacle. Well, what he's actually measured is these posts which form the outer edge of the temple, and we discover that they are 6 cubits square. Now, they may not look square, they may look T-shaped to you, but they are square because we are not yet describing the small projections on either side. Ignore the small projection on either side marked F, and if you took those away, you would just be left with a square of 6 cubits. And that square of 6 cubits is the strong structural member along the outside of the building, and of course those go all the way around the inside of the circle. And we come to the word tabernacle at the end of verse 41. Rather strange word to use. It's the normal word for tabernacle. And yet we find ourselves describing, if we come back now to our combination of plates 9 and 10. He's within the main structure of the building, a very large, solid building, which he describes as a tabernacle. Now, we are, of course, all familiar with the fact that the word tabernacle, the ohel, means a tent. And so by what means can this building be described as a tent? Well, if we go to our concordance, we discover that, yes, the word ohel does mean tent. But what it means is a tent as being conspicuous. And there I would suggest, brethren and sisters, is the clue to the meaning. Remember, we have already said on the first occasion that this building will be elevated on an elevated plane, and upon that elevated plane will be the Hill of Zion. And this building will surround the top of the Hill of Zion. It could hardly be more conspicuous. And so we feel it is going back to its secondary meaning, or the meaning behind the word tent. It is a building which is conspicuous. And we also discover that it comes from a root meaning to be clear or to shine. And this building, brethren and sisters, will be magnificent. It will be the most magnificent building that has ever been upon the surface of the earth. Whether it will literally shine is another matter. But it gives to us the idea of the grandness of the building, of the uniqueness of the building, of the specialness of the building, describing here as being conspicuous and something which shines and shines out. Just turn quickly back to chapter 20. Chapter 20 and verse 15. Chapter 20, verse 15. Yet also I lifted up my hand upon them, this is Yahweh speaking of Israel, in the wilderness, that I would not bring them into the land which I had given them, flowing with milk and honey, which is the glory of all lands. And so this land, the land of promise, of course, described here as being the glory of all lands. And the word glory there is an associated word with the one we were looking at before. It means prominent, conspicuous, and beautiful. And so here we see the ultimate fulfillment of the land of Israel, the land of promise, being the glory of all lands, because the centre is indeed conspicuous. It is prominent and it is beautiful. It also, incidentally, that word glory in Ezekiel 20 comes from a root meaning to array an army against. And that has been the history of that land. No end of armies have been arrayed against it, and one more army will. But after that, brethren and sisters, no more. The glory will be fully revealed, and it will be there for all to see. And there will be no more the Canaanite in the land. And so, coming back to chapter 41, we come to verse 2. And coming back to our enlargement of plan 9, we read verse 2, and the breadth of the door, or you may see in the margin, entrance, was 10 cubits. So remember, he's left the porch behind, he's measured the posts marked D, and he's now measuring what he describes as the door, or the entrance, of 10 cubits. And so all we're being told, quite simply, is that the space between the posts marked G is 10 cubits, and the dimension is noted on the next space down. So the space between the two, the posts then, is 10 cubits. And so we have 6 cubits for a post and 10 cubits for the space between, making 16 cubits, which is, of course, well, it's got to be the same as the 2, 3s and the 5 of the porch. And so we see that the post of the building, the post of the tabernacle, marked D, is exactly opposite the posts of the porch, marked B. And that repeats all the way round, or at least in each section of the building as it goes round. Just remember that detail of 16. It's most important for something we'll come across later. And so we read, and the sides of the door were 5 cubits on one side and 5 cubits on the other side, and he measured the length thereof 40 cubits and the breadth thereof 20. And it appears that the 20 that he's measured, he's gone back and measured the porch, another section of the porch, but because the porch is parallel all the way round, we come to the same dimension of 20. And what he's measuring this time, remember we previously looked at the posts with the the columns on. What we haven't looked at is the other post marked A upon the plan, and the post marked A upon the plan is the one with the cherubim on. Or I should say, those are the ones with the cherubim on, because we saw, remember, from the elevation, the post and the cherubim, the post and the cherubim, all the way around. And so the area marked A is where the cherubim are placed. And if we just look back at plate 10, we see that within the area for the porch, we see on plate 10 the cherubim, one on either side, marked on the plan in the porch, and they repeat all the way around the building. So then, coming back to our enlargement of plate 9 and verse 3. Then he went inward and measured the post of the door 2 cubits, and the door 6 cubits before the temple. So he went out and he measured the marked A, remember, in the porch, and then we read in verse 3, he went inward. So he goes back now into the temple, and we're in this place marked G on plate 9, and he measured the post of the door. Now remember, we referred to the post of the tabernacle, which was marked D, and we referred to the parts that stick out on either side. Now the parts that stick out on either side are the post of the door. Now these marked D, the large 6 cubits square ones, are large because they support the structure of the building itself. The small ones on either side are 2 cubits. If you look down, you may be able to figure out the 2 cubits. It is dimensioned there by the letter F on plan 9. And it's 2 cubits. It's much smaller because it's only associated with the doors rather than the structure of the building itself. And then we read, and the door, still in verse 3, 6 cubits. And so we have a 6-cubit measure. Remember, we have 10 cubits between the posts of the tabernacle. We have 6 cubits between the posts of the door. So the door entrance is only 6 cubits wide. Now, if our arrangement is correct, those dimensions must be consistent the one with the other. And so we have a 2-cubit post, we have a 6-cubit door, we have a 2-cubit post, which plainly is 10, and we've already said the space allowed is 10. So that again gives us comfort that the suggestion, which of course is Brother Sully's, is indeed correct. We then come to verse 3, so we're still in verse 3, and a dimension is given of 7 cubits. And it follows on the 6-cubit measure, still at the end of verse 3. And we must now go to the original plate 9. And what we've just been looking at in the left-hand corner there is a 6-cubit dimension. The space of the doorway on the left-hand side, that is to say, the inside of the circle. The equivalent dimension on the outside of the circle is marked here. It's still marked E with a dash by it on the right-hand side of the circle there. That is 7 cubits. And that's the only dimension, as far as this arrangement of posts is concerned, which forms the structure of the tabernacle itself, that is the only dimension which is different. Now, if we think of our geometry for a moment, it's reasonably obvious that a circle outside of a circle of another circle must be bigger. And so the circumference on the outside of the circle is bigger, and that is allowed for because the doorway, each doorway as we go round, is 1 cubit bigger. The posts are the same size, and that's most important. Because from post to doorway to post, just looking at the centre of the post, the doorway and the centre of the post, is 17 cubits. On the inside of the building, it's 16 cubits. Now, that may not seem so significant, but I assure you, brethren and sisters, it is absolutely vital. If that was not the case, then the whole concept of a circle would be completely discredited. It is vital that the length of the outer circle must be larger than the circumference, that is to say, of the inner circle. Now, what we're about to say, Brother Sully makes the point that he was not aware until he came to prepare the third edition, and somebody else pointed this thing out to him. And the importance of that is, there's a little bit of arithmetic that we're going to indulge in. Brother Sully was oblivious to that at first. He put his dimensions together without the aid of this arithmetic. Now, we must apologise because what we're about to describe, we can't put on the screen, and it would perhaps be easier if we could. So we're going to ask you to use your imagination. That's not strictly true. If we come back to plate 2 and remind ourselves of the block diagram, the length of a side is 3,000 cubits. And so the length of half of one side must be 1,500 cubits. Or to express that same thing another way, from the centre of the altar, or the centre of the circle at D, to one of the edges, he doesn't know which one, is 1,500 cubits. Now, we saw last time that we can pick out quite clearly the dimensions of the outer court. We know that the outer buildings are 40 cubits across. We know that the outer court itself, marked A, is 100 cubits across. We know that the inner range of buildings is the same as the outer, and so is 40. So we know that the full dimension of the outer range of buildings is 180 cubits. Now, something which we haven't looked at, and we shan't look at in any detail, is the space between the inner range of buildings and the outer range, is marked H on plan 2, that is 100 cubits. And so, just to recap, from the outer edge of the building to the outer edge of the circle, including the porch, is 280 cubits. Now, carry on in your mind's eye. We have reached, on plate 9, the point, for want of an expression, marked B with a dash by it on the right-hand side. We can go through the porch, which we've already said is 20, it's the same on either side. We can go across the space, which is marked L, which we'll come across in a moment, which is 5. And we can go part of the way across the post for another 5 cubits to the centre line of the doorway. And so we've already had 180. We can come across another 20 for 280, sorry, so far. Another 20 to make 300, and another 10 to make 310. So we've gone 310 cubits from the very outside edge of the building to the centre line of those doors there, marked B with a dash. Now, we also know, although we haven't looked at it, that from the doorway on the inside to the doorway on the outside is 70 cubits. Now, all that may not seem too significant, but I rather suspect that if there are any third formers in the room, they will be able to tell us that there must be a strict relationship between the outside of the circle, or at least the 17 cubits, the distance between the two range of posts, and the 16 cubits. It is a very, very simple, straight relationship. And it is such that if you take the distance between the two, that is to say, between the inside range of posts, marked D, and the outside range of posts, marked D with a dash, then go to the centre of the doors, it is exactly 70 cubits. If you multiply that by the 17 cubits along the outside section, just one section of arc, you must come to the centre of the circle. It's very simple. If you don't believe me, go home and work it out. It's ever so easy. 17 times 70 must get you to the centre of the circle. That is absolutely vital, brethren and sisters, that if the arithmetic which we have just endeavoured to describe, if it doesn't stack up, this arrangement is wrong. Suffice it to say, it works exactly. In other words, if you multiply the 17 by the distance across, which is the 70, you end up with 1,190 cubits. And if you take the 310 cubits, which we'd already said to that point there, you get exactly the 1,500 cubits. Please satisfy yourself as to the arithmetic. The actual arithmetic doesn't really matter. Suffice it to say, it does work. And as we said before, Brother Sully was not aware that this arithmetical proof could be applied to his building, or rather to the building which he described. That is of a devastating argument to those who are trying to destroy this arrangement of buildings, that is to say the circle, the large range of buildings, the large temple, the 3,000 reeds and so on. We've got the reeds are described exactly, we shall come across them later in chapter 41. It is precise. We might have been satisfied if we'd done the arithmetic, well, you know, we got near enough the right answer, it was in the right sort of field. But now, brethren and sisters, it is precise. We can work to the exact cubit, do the arithmetic, and confirm that Brother Sully's arrangements are precise and exact in the way which he has shown them. And that gives me, at least, depends upon your frame of mind, of course, a great deal of confidence that these things which we have been describing are indeed correct. And so we'll come to verse 4. We just want to pick up one expression from verse 4, the end of verse 4, where he describes and says, "This is the most holy." So whatever he has been describing is most holy, which again points us in the direction of, for want of a better expression, increasing holiness as we get towards the middle, which again supports the idea that the altar is in the middle and that inside the circle is most holy as described in verse 4. We shan't attempt to prove it, but for those taking notes, verse 4 describes the span and the height of the ribs, which we haven't endeavoured to describe yet. And so, verse 5. "After he measured the wall of the house 6 cubits, and the breadth of every side chamber 4 cubits. Now, this, what we're about to say, may at first seem not quite right, because we're going to say that every time the expression side chamber is used, we can substitute there the word rib. And when I first read that explanation, it seemed a bit too convenient. But if we look it up in Strong's Concordance, for example, we shall find that the word side chamber literally means, it's its first meaning, it's not derived or anything, it does mean a rib as curved. And this is straight out of Strong's Concordance. It also means an arch, a floor, or a ceiling. And that could hardly be a better description of those things of which we have been describing. What has been described are what are shown on plan just as dotted lines going across the temple and sort of up and down the length of the temple, looking down on plan upon the arches. If we look on plate 10, we see the arches more clearly, and they would indeed be ribs as being something which was a structural member, something which is curved, something which forms a ceiling, for example on the ground floor. It also forms the floor on the floor above. Now that description isn't something which Brother Sully has put together or I've put together. It's straight out of Strong's Concordance. It's a rib, it's an arch, it's a floor, it's a ceiling. There could not be a more precise word used to describe this arrangement of arches, which in the cross section on plate 10 goes from right to left. And of course, if we think onto the plan on plate 9, it would of course also go up and down the plan and round the building. And so a series of arches then going from left to right and north and south, all the way around. So these arches then form the structure of the building. And these arches are mentioned all the way through these verses in verse 41. The side chambers are mentioned time and again, and they are these ribs or arches. So we'll come to verse 6. The side chambers, that is the ribs, were three, one over the other, 30 in order. They entered into the wall, which was of the house, for the ribs or the side chambers round about, that they might have hold. And if we go back to the proper plate 9, we see two thick lines towards the top of the building. That is the wall, which is described as being the wall for the ribs to have a hold. In other words, as the arches go along the length of the building, where they stop, they must have something strong to go to, and it is this wall which is being described here. It's marked J on plate 9. And now we come to verse 7, which again has provided a field day for those who would discredit Brother Sully, but it really is a marvellous description of what he has described. Verse 7. There was an enlarging, a winding about still upward to the ribs, for the winding about of the house went.
Plate 10, we see that each arch, as it comes to its base, if we think of the base of the arch and our eyes travel upwards, then the base would be a certain dimension, it's 4 cubits. But as we go higher and go further up, it gets bigger because the arch comes into play, and the width then of what starts off just as a column must get bigger as it goes up. And what you must remember, of course, is it's the same in the other axis. In other words, it gets bigger from left to right and across the way. So, looking down on plan view, you have the base, and it gets bigger as it goes away to the left, to the right, and to the north and to the south. And that arrangement, of course, goes across the building, it goes round the building, and it carries on up through the building. So everywhere that you look, you get this concept of something which, this rib arrangement, this arch arrangement, which gets bigger, the dimensions get bigger as they go up. Rather than think of the arch as going across that way, think of two halves back to back, and they get, the dimension across gets bigger as you rise up through the arch. And really, that's all that's being described in verse 7. A series of arches all joining together back to back. And so, if we come down to verse 12... No, we'll go back to verse 11. Verse 11. And the doors of the side chambers, the ribs, were towards the place that was left. One door toward the north, another door toward the south, and the breadth of the place left was 5 cubits. And the place left is marked L. It is the space between the porch and the temple itself, marked L on plate 9, and there's one on the outside, and there's one on the inside. If we look at plate 10, it's the place towards the inside. You see where the cherubim is there. You see the porch on the right-hand side. There's a place which is left, a space, a corridor, before we come to the posts of the building. And the same arrangement on the other side, by the lion's head there. And so we see described a place left. It's a corridor which runs around the building between the two elements, that is to say, between the porch and the temple. And that arrangement, brethren and sisters, is very common in public buildings. It's an arrangement which we can find, for example, in Birmingham Town Hall,
We find the same arrangement at the Royal Albert Hall in London. In other words, you can go in at any of the doorways on the outside. Having gone in, you can then move around the building undercover before you find the door that you actually want to get into the part of the building that you're really after. So it's not necessary to know when you're on the outside where you need to be when you're on the inside. It's a very sensible, very important arrangement described there by Brother Sully, and described more importantly in the word at chapter 41 verse 11 as the place left, and it's 5 cubits round about, 5 cubits before the full length. Coming down now to verse 16. The doorposts and the narrow windows. The narrow windows are the same sort of narrow windows that we saw described in the outer court gates. They are some sort of open fretwork, trellis work, call it what you will. But it's basically, it's a structural thing, but which has holes in it, rather like a trellis, but rather more substantial. So we have this sort of narrow window arrangement in verse 16. The galleries round about on their three stories, so there's the evidence for the three stories above. Over against the door, sealed with wood. Now that expression, sealed with wood, we understand from Brother Sully, the word sealed can mean thin trees. And so we saw in the elevation that there was marked on there, looking at plate 10, there is foliage. And you see a sort of a fretwork being shown there. And what is being described, thin trees, which would seem to take hold upon the trellis work. Perhaps vines, we don't know. We aren't told, and we are left to guess. And so we have those thin trees described in verse 16, which give rise to the idea, or part of it, that there is this foliage marked round the outside of the building. Come down to verses 18 and 19, and we see the evidence for the cherubim around the porch between the posts. Verse 18, it was made with cherubim and palm trees, so that a palm tree was between a cherub and the cherub, and every cherub had two faces. Now some have said, well, poor Brother Sully, he didn't know any technical words, so he saw these columns and he called them palm trees. Not so, brethren and sisters. It's a technical word. It's actually a pilaster. Near enough, it is a pillar, which looks like a palm tree in the sense that it is something which is strong, something which is upright, and has an enlargement, a capital, on the top. So it's a very adequate word, a very the correct word, used, of course, under inspiration. And so we must not detract from these words. They are quite precise. And they are the word of God speaking to us how he is going to build or have built the temple of the age to come. And so in verse 18, the cherubim with the two faces. Verse 19, the lion and the man. And so that is the evidence for having the lion and the man all the way around the outside between the posts, the two faces of the cherubim. And so the cherubim are described in verses 18 and 19. And in verse 22, we come across the expression, the altar of wood. And at the end of verse 22, we read, this is the table that is before Yahweh. And that is the point at which we shall open our remarks in the second half, God willing. Son of man, hast thou seen this? Is, of course, the following verse from the one which we have just read, and relates particularly to the waters which were issuing forth from under the gates. We shall come to that in a moment, God willing, but we shall pick up where we left off, which was in chapter 41 and verse 22. The altar of wood was 3 cubits high, the length thereof 2 cubits, the corners thereof, the length thereof, and the walls thereof were of wood. I did come across one explanation that would try to have us believe that this altar was an altar in the conventional sense, that is to say, for putting offerings upon. It's reasonably obvious, of course, that that is about the last thing it can be, because it is an altar of wood. And so what is being described here is something which we might be more inclined to describe as a table, but it is nevertheless an altar. It is therefore associated with offerings, but it is not the place where the offerings are actually consumed with fire. For one thing, we should discover it's well within the building, and for another, as we can see, it is made of wood. And we see the dimensions there. The altar of wood in verse 22 was 3 cubits high, and the length thereof 2 cubits. Now, we're only given 2 dimensions, which would lead us to suppose that this particular item is something which is continuous around the building. Now, it can only be continuous for each section of the temple as it goes round in its sections of the circle, because we saw on one of the plates that there was a large wall for the arches to go into. So that, nevertheless, apart from that, would seem to be this altar which goes the length along an arc, that is to say, of the building. And we see it's relatively small as far as this temple goes. It's only 3 cubits high, and it's 2 cubits is the other dimension, the width. And Brother Sully is moved to suggest that these aren't the cubits of the cubit and a hand breadth, but these are the secular cubits, and though it makes it rather much smaller. Because otherwise we have the level, the height of this table is about 6 feet high. Well, we can follow that line of thought, or we can alternatively stay with a consistent cubit throughout the building, and there is no reason why there shouldn't be some steps which enable access to the surface of the table. There are several other instances where we have quite large jumps in level, but no steps are mentioned, and we feel that there would be steps to enable people to move from one part of the building to another along vertical distances of a cubit or more. And something similar along these lines. Now let's try then and locate this altar. We notice where it comes in the description, because in verse 21, the posts of the temple were squared. So we've seen the posts of the temple, which are square. They are those posts marked D, and these posts of the structure marked D or D with a dash. And so he described those as being square. And in verse 22, we then have this altar or table of wood. And we have described in verse 23, the temple and the sanctuary had 2 doors. So clearly, we are in the region of these doors and posts. Well, we should, that's rather confusing, it's just nearer to touch. We should be over on the inside. It's only mentioned once, and it seems to be in relation to the posts and the doors, which are on the inside of the circle by the inner porch, and it's within the place left, marked L. Now, if we look at plate 10, and we look on the left-hand side by the lion, you just see down by his feet, just there, the table in cross-section. It's 3 cubits high, it's 2 cubits across, and the other dimension which we're not given is presumably It's only a suggestion because it runs the full length from the one wall across here right the way to the other. Now immediately some would suggest this can't possibly be right, because here we have a temple building which has doors, and as soon as you come to the door we have a table right the way across. An absurd arrangement. What possible use could that be? Well, the answer is a very good one. If we look at our enlargement of plate 10, the right hand side of our enlargement there is the temple buildings. We come through the doors, and the space sort of between the L and the G, we see two parallel lines going down there. That is a plan view of this altar which is being mentioned, the altar of wood, within the space martel, which is the place left. Well, what's it for? We notice it is described as the end of verse 22, this is the table that is before Yahweh. So again, that would associate in our minds, it is something to do with the innermost part of the building, that is to say, within the most holy. It is the table that is before Yahweh. Just refresh our memories and go back over to chapter 44, and describing the mortal priests, verse 33, they shall not come near unto me. Chapter 44, verse 13, mortal priests shall not come near unto me. Contrast that, verse 15, the priests, the Levites, the sons of Zadok, that is the immortal priesthood, that kept the charge of my sanctuary when the children of Israel went astray from me, they shall come near unto me, shall minister unto me, shall stand before me to offer unto me the fat and the blood, saith Yahweh, and they shall enter into my sanctuary and come near to my table. Now it may well be that the table of verse 16 is actually a reference to the altar itself in the centre. It could also be that table which runs around the outside. It is described in verse 22 as the table of verse, so we're in, back into chapter 41 now, verse 22, it is the table that is before the Lord, which I think is consistent with what we saw in chapter 44. So what is described, I believe, is that at this point, this table is the point at which the mortal priests give the sacrifices to the immortal priests. Up to that point, the mortal priest can leave the offering upon that table, and then the immortal priest can take it and place it upon the altar in the centre. Because from that point onwards, it is described as most holy, and the table itself is before Yahweh. That's just an idea. You may have others of your own. Coming back to verse 24 of chapter 21, verse 24, the doors. And here we have the justification for having these sort of double door type arrangements. You may be able to see on plate 9, between the posts, a curved dotted line. That's the architectural fashion for showing the movement of a door. And we see that there are double doors, and that's described in verse 22, 23 and onwards. The temple and the sanctuary had two doors, and the doors had two leaves apiece. Two turning leaves. Two leaves for the one door, and two leaves for the other door. And so we have an outer door of 10, an inner door of 6, or 7 if you're on the outside, all of them double doors. And so we see the decoration which is upon them, verse 25, there were made upon them, on the doors of the temple, cherubim and palm trees, likewise were made upon the walls, and there were thick planks upon the face of the porch without. Now remember that we've already seen described the thin trees. Here we have this expression, thick planks in verse 25. The word planks can be rendered trees, and the word thick can be rendered envelope. So in other words, we are told that the envelope of the building comprises of the trees. And this again is the justification for Brother Sully having foliage upon the outside and upon the roof of the building. So the sceptic would say, what happens when it rains? To which we would reply that we believe that Eden will be restored. And we may recall that in Eden the means of watering the land and the ground was that a mist went up to water. There wasn't any rain until the flood. And we believe, can't prove it, it would be nice to do so, we believe that that circumstance was good enough for creation and was described as being very good. And we believe that that circumstance will prevail in the age to come. You can, as they say, take that or leave it. Turn with me now then to Acts and chapter 3. Because we come now to what is really intended to be our second address. We've already intimated that we believe that a good deal of Eden, that is to say the physical benefits of living in the world which was created very good, will be restored. And it's one of the things which I believe is referred to in Acts chapter 3, very well known words, in verse 21. Whom the heaven must receive, talking of Christ of course, until the times of restitution of all things, which God hath spoken by the mouth of his holy prophets since the world began. Now we aren't told what things are being restored, but there isn't really much room for options or suggestions. And I would suggest that the only two options are that the state of natural things as far as Eden is concerned, being very good, will be restored. And the only other thing that can sensibly be restored is the law. And I believe that Eden and the law will be restored and are referred to in chapter 3 of Acts and verse 21. It's most important, brethren and sisters, that we accept that the law may be in an amended form, but nevertheless the majority of the law will exist in the time of the age to come. We've already seen that there will be a restitution of all things. We saw in an earlier address that there were slaying blocks along the one side of the temple. We saw that having gone into the porchway in the outer court, there were flaying blocks and there were hooks for supporting the animal and for dismembering the animal and so on. We have seen that there is an altar. Can there be any doubt that there are animal sacrifices? Come to Jeremiah in chapter 33. Jeremiah 33, verse 14. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will perform that good thing which I have promised unto the house of Israel and to the house of Judah. And in those days and at that time will I cause the branch of righteousness to grow up unto David, and he shall execute judgment and righteousness in the land. So there's no doubt that we are in the time of the kingdom. And in those days, verse 16, shall Judah be saved. Jerusalem shall dwell safely. This is the name wherewith she shall be called, the Lord our righteousness. And so on, verse 17. For thus saith the Lord, David shall never want a man to sit on the throne of the house of Israel, because it will be Christ. Neither shall the priests, the Levites, want a man before me to offer burnt offerings, because it will be the sons of Zadok, and to kindle meat offerings, and to do sacrifice continually. It's most emphatic, brethren and sisters, that there will be offerings made, that is to say, burnt offerings and meat offerings which are kindled upon the altar continually. So says the inspired prophet Jeremiah. Just turn back a page or two to Isaiah and chapter 56. Malachi 56 and verse 6. Sorry, what did I say? It's Isaiah 56, verse 6. And the sons of the stranger that join themselves unto the Lord to serve him and to love the name of the Lord and to be his servants, every one that keepeth the Sabbath from polluting it and taketh hold of my covenant, even them will I bring to my holy mountain to make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices shall be accepted upon mine altar, for mine house shall be called an house of prayer for all people. Could it be more emphatic? The sacrifices will be upon the altar, which is the house of prayer for all people, as they take their offerings and present them to Yahweh that they have not before had any notion of. And it's all part and parcel of the education of the people. Staying with the prophets, and we move on to Malachi. Malachi and chapter 3. Malachi 3. And the first four verses: Behold, I will send my messenger, he shall prepare the way before me, and the Lord whom ye seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant whom ye delight in, and behold, he shall come, saith Yahweh of hosts. And the end of verse 3, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. So the people will be educated, and they will offer in righteousness. Then shall the offering of Judah and Jerusalem be pleasant unto Yahweh, as in the days of old, as in the former years. Sacrifice, brethren and sisters, restored in the kingdom. Well, we accept then that there are sacrifices. And we are told quite clearly in Ezekiel that there are sacrifices, although we haven't looked at them in particular. Which may, for some, raise the question, why? Come with me, please, to Romans and chapter 5. Romans and chapter 5. And verse 20. Moreover, the law entered that the offence might abound. But where sin abounded, grace did yet more abound. The law entered that the offence might abound. Until there is a law, there is no offence. And there will be millions of people upon the surface of the earth who have got absolutely no concept whatsoever about righteous sacrifice and righteous offerings and acceptable worship and acceptable behaviour in the sight of God. They will have to be taught. and they will have to be taught as to how it can be that there can be this man called Jesus Christ, whom a number of perhaps never even heard of. And yet here he is, the dictator of the whole earth. Well, how did he get to be in that position? Who is he? Where did he come from and why? Galatians and chapter 3. I expect you know it off by heart. Galatians and chapter 3 and verse 24. We tend to think of this as our academic studies in the law teach us about our understanding of Christ in our covenant relationship with Christ, and that is perfectly true. I wouldn't wish to deny that for one moment. But just apply this now to teaching of the masses who again have no concept of Christ. Verse 23, but before faith came, we were under the law. Shut up unto faith, which would afterward be revealed. Wherefore the law was our schoolmaster to bring us unto Christ, that we might be justified by faith. Now that applies to us. That we might be justified by faith. The people in the age to come cannot be justified by faith in the same way. Because what is our faith? Part of our faith, at least, concerns the name of Jesus Christ and the things concerning the kingdom of God. Well, you can't have faith in that, brethren and sisters, if you're already living in that dispensation. Our faith is that that dispensation is shortly to come. The other part of our faith, of course, is the saving name of the Lord Jesus Christ and the efficacy of his blood. But that on one side for the moment. The law then is a schoolmaster. The law is the one that brings us unto Christ. It can show us about Christ. It can show us of our own unworthiness. It can show us that we are the one that is worthy of death. And that is the lesson which the millions will have to learn in the age to come. They can't be drawn to Christ and show and have faith in him and in his return, because he'll be there. Their faith will inevitably be a different one. Still in Galatians and chapter 3, verse 19, which makes the same point as we saw before. Wherefore then serveth the law? What was it for? It was added because of transgressions, until the seed should come to whom the promise was made. And then coming down to the end of verse 22, that the promise by faith of Jesus Christ might be given to them that believe. That's you and I, brethren and sisters, if we remain faithful. Those in the age to come will not be able to believe in something which is there in front of them. Stay in Romans, go back to Romans, chapter 8 and verse 24, which I think makes the point. Romans chapter 8 and verse 24, for we are saved by hope. There's the importance of our hope, brethren and sisters. We are saved by hope. But hope that is seen is not hope. For what a man seeth, why doth he yet hope for? So therefore, brethren and sisters, just to emphasise the point, the mortals that live in the kingdom age live in a different dispensation. Their faith and their hope is different to ours, because they will not have that same hope. And therefore, when we come to verses such as Hebrews and chapter 12, let's have a look at it. It has caused many to have doubts. said Hebrews 12, it's Hebrews 10. No, I wanted to look right. Hebrews 10 and verse 10. By the which will we are sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. So there the critic says, there you are, sacrifice of Christ once for all. There can't possibly be any sacrifice in the kingdom. It is for a different dispensation. It is once for all for us, for we who believe on these things. But for those who don't even believe, for those who are coming to the temple in order to be educated, how can they believe if they don't even understand? They come, they bring their offerings, they are educated. The means of their education is the law and the singing, which we mentioned in our first address. So then, sacrifice restored in the age to come. Come back then to chapter 41. No, chapter 40 and verse 47. Now we have a diagram of the altar which we'll put on the screen. It won't be terribly useful, but it's not a very good one. But suffice it to say, we aren't going to concern ourselves particularly with the detail of the altar. The detail of the altar comes down to measurements of sort of 1, 2, 3, and 4 cubits, which we can't really hope to try and discuss in this type of arrangement. Suffice it to say, we'll content ourselves with an overall view. Verse 47, so he measured the court, which we've suggested was the altar, which pertained to the altar, and 100 cubits long and 100 cubits broad. It's verse 47 of chapter 40. So the altar itself then is square, and the court that contains the altar has this measure of 100 cubits. We'll leave chapter 40 at that point and go on to chapter 43. Now, as we said, there's a lot of detail in chapter 43. We just have to leave that for our own investigations. Verse 13, chapter 43. These are the measures of the altar after the cubits. The cubit is the cubit and a hand breadth. Even the bottom shall be a cubit, and the breadth a cubit, and the border thereof. As we said before, we aren't going to concern ourselves with the detail. But we are going to come down to verses 15 and onwards. Verse 15, so the altar shall be 4 cubits. That seems to be a vertical measure, but we'll leave that. And notice, in verse 15, in the authorised margin at least, you will see that the altar is the mountain of God. Now, the mountain of God is associated with the law, and it's associated with Jerusalem. The first expression comes in Exodus and chapter 4. We'll have a quick look. Exodus and chapter 4. This is the first use of this expression, the mountain of God. It's Exodus, it's chapter 4, and it's verse 27. And the Lord said unto Aaron, Exodus 4:27, go into the wilderness to meet Moses. And he went and met him in the mount of God and kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord that he had sent him and all the signs which he had commanded him. So here we have at the beginning of the Exodus a reference to the mountain of God. And so the mountain of God is associated then with the giving of the law, with the drawing out of the people of Israel. So they went into the wilderness, they were given the law, and we don't wish to draw any other inference other than to say that's the first usage, and it's associated with Moses and Aaron and the law. We come now to Daniel and chapter 9, because Daniel and chapter 9 more clearly associated with Jerusalem in particular. Daniel chapter 9, verse 16, and then verse 20. O Lord, according to all thy righteousness, I beseech thee, let thine anger and thy fury be turned away from thy city Jerusalem, thy holy mountain, because for our sins and for the iniquities of our fathers, Jerusalem and thy people are become a reproach to all that are about us. So the holy mountain then, associated, well indeed it is of course, Jerusalem. And again in verse 20, and whilst I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain of my God. So the holy mountain then is Jerusalem. And notice the context there. It is one of Daniel praying for judgment to be withheld or lessened, being brought upon Jerusalem. And that is brought more particularly if we go now to Ezekiel and chapter 28. Ezekiel chapter 28 and verse 16, by the multitude of thy merchandise they have filled the midst of thee with violence, thou hast sinned, therefore I will cast thee as profane out of the mountain of God, and I will destroy thee, O covering cherub, or better rendered with the covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. So that the mountain of God has judgment brought upon it because of the sins of the people. And that, we believe, is the highest point of Mount Zion. It is the mountain of God, it is the centre of Jerusalem, and it is upon that that the altar will be built. So the top of the mountain is referred to as the mountain of God, coming back to chapter 43 and verse 15. Now, in association with that, we have verse 16, which says, and the altar shall be 12 cubits long and 12 cubits broad, or at least 12 broad. Let's stay with the altar for a moment. Again, you may see from the margin that the margin renders it the aerial of God. And the aerial speaks of the lion. The aerial is the Hebrew for the lion of God. Rendered in other versions, we understand, I think it's the Revised Version margin, which has it the lion of the hearth of God. And of course the hearth of God is the place where the sacrifice is to take place. In this connection, just one reference, we'll have a look at Isaiah and verse and chapter 29. Isaiah 29, verse 1, woe to Ariel, the same word as Ezekiel 43, and to Ariel, the city of where David dwelt. And so judgment is being brought upon the city. It's called Ariel. And we were only using this particular verse to show that Jerusalem Ariel is a name for Jerusalem. And it is the lion or the hearth of God. Now the lion, of course, speaks to us of Christ. We take that as read. We're not going to try and prove it. We just look at a couple of the dimensions, because we have in verse 16, the altar shall be 12 cubits long, and then a little later in verse 17, we have the settle shall be 14 cubits long. At least it says cubits in the authorised version. You may note that the cubits are in italics, and we should therefore render it reeds. Now the 14 reeds would give us a measure of 84 cubits, and that 84 cubits is therefore consistent or in proportion with the measure of 100 cubits, which we saw in chapter 41. And so we have the top of the mountain, so to speak, would seem to be this court of 100 cubits. Within that court there is what is described as a settle, we won't go into that, of 84 cubits. And then within that again, there is the base of the altar itself, described as the Lion of God, which is 12 reeds long and 12 reeds square. So the altar then, the actual base of the altar itself, 12 reeds square. And again, the critic comes along and says, well, that's far too big. How could you possibly get the sacrifices into the middle of the altar? To which we would suggest that it is not a problem, because those who administer the sacrifices of the altar will be immortal, and all things will be possible. That may seem a slick answer to some, but I do believe that that is the case. It is this 12 reeds square, and I do not believe that the size presents a problem, because it will be the immortal and therefore powerful saints who will be administering these things. And we come just a description at the end of verse 17, and the end of verse 17, his stairs shall look toward the east. Now the stairs isn't necessarily stairs as we understand the term. It does indicate some sort of slope or rising of some description, and the reason for that is fairly obvious. We've said that the altar is on the top of the mountain, and so there must be some means of getting from the lower slopes of the mountain up to the altar, and this word stairs is used. As we said, it's some form of rising. Perhaps not stairs as such, if we won't turn to it now, but if you compare Exodus 20 and verse 26 sometime, you will see that steps and stairs were not to be associated with those who are making the offerings. We'll leave the altar at that point, except to say that it is from the altar that the waters issue forth. And we turn now to chapter 47. Chapter 47 and verse 1. Afterward he brought me again unto the door of the house, and behold, waters issued out from under the threshold of the house eastward. For the forefront of the house stood toward the east, and the waters came down from under the right side of the house at the south side of the altar. So there is no doubt, because of the end of verse 1 of chapter 27, that water issues from the south side of the altar. And we are told how those waters get from the south side of the altar to the outside of the outer court of the temple. We do not know. There is considerable surmise. You can read that for yourself. We aren't this evening dealing in surmisings. It's reasonably obvious, of course, that the water can come down the side of the mountain, but how it gets from the bottom of the mountain out to the outside, we aren't told. But suffice it to say, the waters are described as going eastward, the middle of verse 1, the threshold of the house, and they were going eastward. And verse 2, then brought he me out of the way of the gate northward. So he's gone onto the north side of the building, and he has in fact gone onto the west side. So the northwest corner, we should say. We'll just have a look at the block plan, which is plan 2. And he's gone now in verse 2, as Ezekiel, he has gone to the northwest corner. And the reason we suggest that is because, stay in verse 2, he's on the northern side, we're told that without any doubt. So he's gone to the utter gate, so he's right on the outside of the building, by the way that looketh eastward. And behold, there ran out waters on the right side. So he's over here, and the way to the east is on his right. And so the waters then are seen coming out from the thresholds, which we saw on another occasion. They're on the outside of the building, and water comes from the location of the doorway. Now, plainly it can't be exactly at the doorway. We shall see why in a moment. It gradually gets deeper. So the water comes out from near the threshold, or at the threshold, and joins together in a series of small streams from each of the thresholds as we travel towards the east. And the reason that we suggest that the streams join together is the following verses. Verse 3. When the man that had the line in his hand went forth eastward, he measured 1,000 cubits, and he brought me through the waters, and the waters were to the ankles. So for the first 1,000 cubits, the waters are come to ankle deep. And verse 4, he measured 1,000 and he brought me through the waters, and the waters were to the knees. And he measured 1,000 and they were, and he brought me through, and the waters were to the loins. And he measured 1,000 and it was a river that he could not pass over. And remember that the outside face of the building is 3,000 cubits. And here we have Ezekiel describing 3 different sections, each of 1,000. And then a fourth, where he said it's too deep to walk through. And here, I believe, is an incidental confirmation of the fact, A, that the building is large in the first place, and B, that there are a number of doors, a number of thresholds, therefore, for the water to come out of. Because only with that arrangement can you have a series of small streams or tributaries coming out from under each of the doorways, combining to make this river, which gets gradually deeper and deeper. It must therefore be something along the lines indicated in plate number 2. And when we come down to verse 9, we notice that it shall come to pass that everything that liveth, which moveth, and whithersoever the rivers, notice plural, the margin has the 2 rivers shall come. And that's a justification for having a river on the north and the river on the south. And so the rivers come, and indeed the rivers split, and they go north and south. But just notice these rivers. Verse 7. Now when I had returned, behold, at the bank of the river were very many trees on the one side and on the other side. And this is a similar description to that which we find in the book of Revelation. And the book of Revelation is speaking of spiritual things. It is a book of sign, we know that well. Here we have its literal counterpart. So there are many trees, and they go out to the east country, verse 8, and go down to the desert, go down to the sea, which being brought forth unto the sea, the waters shall be healed. And so the Dead Sea then is healed. In verse 9, it shall come to pass that everything which liveth and moveth, Whithersoever the river shall come shall live. So these aren't just ordinary waters, brethren and sisters. These are the waters which emanate from under the altar, and they give life. There's a multitude of fish, and at the end of verse 9, everything shall live whither the river cometh. And we see the multitude of fish in verse 10. The miry places aren't going to be healed in verse 11. But just notice verse 12. By the river and upon the bank thereof, on this side and on that side, shall grow all the trees for meat, whose leaf shall not fade, neither shall the fruit thereof be consumed. It shall bring forth new fruit according to his months, not according to his years as now, but according to his months, so there will be plenty to eat from the trees. And at the end of the verse, the leaf thereof for medicine. There won't be any use for the drugs and all their side effects which we find in the world today. These trees which are come and are fed from the waters of life are such that the leaf thereof is for medicine, or the note the margin has, for bruises and for sores. And so then, brethren and sisters, hast thou seen this? It's been a privilege to try to explain these things so that together we may thrill at the thoughts of the age to come. And I'll leave you with this one thought. As we contemplate the age to come, which surely, brethren and sisters, cannot be far away. But just think of that temple building, with all its ribs going throughout the building. Those ribs which we said, the same word as the rib which we find in Genesis chapter 2, where Eve was taken out of the side of Adam. Each one of those ribs, which so many have mocked, represents you and I, as the bride, taken out of the side of her husband. For as we read elsewhere, know ye not that ye are the temple of the living God.